Okay, here we are. Never fear, as we roll into Friday tomorrow already. Wow. Okay, many of you really enjoyed hearing from Doug and Berta. We're going to call her Bertie, because everybody does, and I think we're family here. So, Doug and Bertie Lockhart are back tonight to talk about, well, how would we phrase it? Souls. Human souls, or perhaps those who are in transit, kind of hung up. The book is Souls of the Asylum. It's a remarkable book, and you can see it under their names. It's also, you can find it easily on Amazon. Where did I find it? I just typed in Doug and Berta Lockhart, Lockhart, and there's the book. And right on the front cover of the book is a, well, it's the photo that's always on the book, but it's very interesting. There's a monument marker with the number 284 chiseled into the top of it. It's obviously an old marker, and there are many other just like it. And I think if you were with us last time, you'll understand what that generally stands for. It's an identifying marker for someone buried there. No name. No names. Just a number. All right, are you there, folks? Bertie, are you there first? Ladies first.
Yes, we are. Thank you so much for having us back, Jeff, and thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. We're excited to share more of our journey with this.
Wow, you have a long story. We may do quite a few episodes. We'll see how it goes. This is each one is different. This is going to be, I think, very interesting, and I have an idea where this is all going to eventually lead to, and it's a fascinating destination. Doug, are you there?
Can you hear me? I am. I'm here. We're all fighting, getting over cold, so if we sound a little stuffy, it's just because of that reason.
Well, it's not supposed to be cold season yet, is it? It's summer.
Something is in the...
You sound fine. No problem. The book, Souls of the Asylum, has many tentacles of fascination to it. And we're going to step into the number 284 tonight. How did that monument end up in that photo? Was it just random? Somebody just took the picture and that was selected for the cover of the book?
No, Jeff, hardly anything is random in this story. Oh.
I hear that. All right.
The way that story happened was Bertie and I wanted to find out who was in Ted's group. This group that was in the non-physical that was speaking to us from the other side.
Right.
There was apparently 177 of them. So we found some interesting information at the Historical Society in Athens. We went there. There's a huge old book. And it is the handwritten ledger of all the people that are buried at the cemetery. They actually have, they know who is buried under each of these stones. Yet, in those graves with just a numbered headstone and not their name. That was interesting. And I'm going to circle back to that because I have my own theory on why that is. At first, it made me very angry, but then I kind of came up with some more information. So we're at the Historical Society with a big piece of paper, and just a little side note. In my youth, I never learned to write cursive. I never.
Yeah, you said that last time. You're one of the few Americans left. Although that said, I think we should look now at Gen Z, and they're not even being taught cursive in many schools. They're being taught to print. That's it.
Correct.
So. You're going to have a lot of company soon.
Yeah, so I was in that group also just earlier, and this was the old-fashioned, very scriptive cursive handwriting, very difficult to read. So,
oh, it's stylish? You mean with extra little twirls and twills and things like that?
Right, for sure.
Gotcha.
So the way I did this was I opened the page, I'm sitting at a desk, and I ran my hand down the page, and I would get this small electrical charge, like a static charge, and I'd say, okay, here's one, and I would look, And I would write that number down, then I would write that name down, and I would close my eyes and do some more, and I'd get another charge. And I was getting these hits on these names and numbers, and then the words came in my head and said, this is just taking forever, because it was so slow for me to do this. And they said, let me just give you the numbers. I said, fine, that would be way easier. So I just started writing down number after number after number, and I didn't even grave numbers. I didn't even go through the book. So I'm going down, and I hit this number 284, and something very emotional happened inside of me. I got, my chest was very tight. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't sit still. I got really upset and emotional. And the words came that I wrote down in the original manuscript. It says, sorry, that's for later. Let's continue on. And a big circle went around it. So I said, okay, and I kept going, and we go all the way down, and we were doing our research, and we got all the numbers. Now, what happens was a veteran came to me, and he said, hello, my name is Josiah Whiskey. This is my grave number. These are my details. And most of the time, they would say things like, this is where I was born. These are my parents, siblings, a lot of detail that I shouldn't really know, but they're sharing with me.
Now, just for our listeners, let me, I might do this a couple times. Let me just drop in here that the asylum was the home for a lot of Confederate, Civil War veterans. I don't want to say who was there, North or South, but there were veterans there. Go ahead.
Right, and it was not only Civil War, but it was Spanish-American. It was First World War and some Second World War.
Oh, really? See, I didn't know that. Yeah. Here's another thing, Doug. Let me just quickly put this out there. Mental health used to be a kind of a normative problem that lots of people ran into trouble with. And there used to be what they called asylums all over the country. When I was a little kid, there was still one that was shut down, but it was the Fairview Mental Hospital, I think was the name of it. There were mental hospitals everywhere to help people emotionally compete with their troubles, with society, whatever. It wasn't frowned upon as some psychopath. Not like it is now. Please go ahead.
Right. So the Civil War ends in 1865. In 1868, the thought was, we need to build a facility. And the first stone was laid in 68, and it was opened in 1873. And its main purpose was to deal with the fallout from the Civil War. Within the civilians and the soldiers themselves. So I know I'm going to get sidetracked, but it's important that I address what you just mentioned. We didn't realize, we just thought a mental institution was for psychiatric people. But we found out there was a ton of reasons that you could be admitted to the asylum. So this asylum was one of the largest employers in the state of Ohio at the time. And I mean, they had a huge farm. They had industry. They had woodworking shops. They had broom making. They had all kinds of different vocations. And if you were found to be a vagrant, a homeless man, you weren't sick, so you didn't go to the hospital. You didn't do anything wrong, so you didn't go to prison. So this is their choice. It was the in-between. We found a young girl that was in the asylum. She was 6 or 7, and she grabbed a pot of apple butter on the stove, knocked it over on herself, burned her chest, and disfigured her face.
Oh, terrible.
Then, socially unacceptable, and ended up in the asylum and lived there for 30 or more years.
Mm-hmm.
There was another case where a young woman was admitted to the asylum every 28 days.
How does that work? She just was on a cycle once a month? She'd show up and be admitted?
It was for her menstrual cycle. So there was,
that's what I'm saying. Go ahead.
Right. There was such a large, we have an African-American sergeant in the U.S. Army in the war, He was admitted and was in there for a number of years. He's actually buried there because he couldn't sleep at night. So here's some of the earliest PTSD, you know, issues that were being seeing themselves. Lots of reasons. So back to our story then. I had a Civil War veteran come to me, and he told me these details, and I wrote them all down. Now our archivist,
you met a Civil War veteran. You're going to have to be a little more explicit about that. Okay. You had one come to you spiritually.
Correct.
Okay.
Spiritual. This is all in the non-physical.
Got it.
They would come and they would say, "My name is Josiah Whipke. I'm under stone number 89, if I remember, something like that. And these are my details." Because he's laying up there and he's not recognized by his country as being a veteran. So I would take this information, I'd give it to our archivist, he would do the research, and then he would approach the Veterans Administration and verify his service, and then all of a sudden he starts getting a flag by the Veterans Administration on Memorial Day and Veterans Day. So I give him this information, and he says, "This is amazing. This, everything panned out, except there were some issues in here that things just didn't line up." So if we go to our early manuscript, when this person was talking, I was seeing insignias on a uniform. I was seeing colors. I saw this man riding away from me on a wagon, looking over his shoulder while I was getting this information. So I have this detail.
Doug, if I might, to help set this a little better in people's minds, where were you when you were getting this information? Asleep? Trying to sleep?
I'm sitting at my table.
I
did was...
And you're getting visuals along with the actual communication.
Correct.
Very good.
All kinds of visuals on this entire... That was why this is such an emotional piece, because everything that I would hear, I would see. I was a third person just looking in, and I would see all of these details. So what happened, I would prepare myself. I'd sit at the table. I'd light a candle. And when I would light a candle, then I was declaring, "I'm setting aside a time that you can approach me, and I'm here to listen." So I sat at my table. I started hearing these things. I start closing my eyes. I see things. I'm writing as fast as I absolutely can physically write. And so what happened was this archivist said, I'm confused because half of this story matches this person, but half of it did not. And so I started getting really upset because it's like, why are these spirits deceiving me? Why are you telling me things that are confusing or not fitting? So he says, "Well, calm down. Hang on. Let's do something." We separated everything that went on to this one soldier, and we separated everything that did not fit, and we put it in this category. And then what happened was I started hearing another voice, and this was a
number 284.
This is the number 284 that was speaking, and he said, "Hello, my name is James Douglas. This is my story." And all of a sudden, all of the details that were entwined, because I was seeing two Civil War soldiers overlapping, and I just wrote all the information down, but there was actually two speakers.
So Jeff, in essence, Doug is remembering his past life. So that's why mixed in with the other Civil War soldier that was telling his story. But he overlapped it with the memories that were coming back to him as he was hearing this other Civil War soldier who was in the asylum at the same time that Doug was.
What was your name back then, Doug, back in the day?
I'm glad you just asked that. That's where Bertie was leading to. I wasn't aware of these details until it all started to unfold. His name was James Douglas,
number
284, and he was born... we did the research. He was born in 1838, and he was wounded in Vicksburg. He told us about that. He was in Ohio's heavy artillery. So now, all of a sudden, I start getting really emotional.
Wait, but to get back to the name, That was number 284, James Douglas. And your current name in this life experience is
Douglas James Lockhart. Now, that's just...
How funny. Yeah.
Crazy. That's just a crazy coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, maybe not.
Right.
Well, if souls continue as they do, they're going to be carryovers and memories and things. Yeah. I don't think that's a big surprise. But 284, so here we are. It's our second visit with Doug and Birdie. Number 284 on that marker is James Douglas?
Correct.
Correct.
And that's you back in the day. And are you, when James and the other soldier who were talking to you almost over each other, did he ever say to you, Doug, I'm you? Or anything like that?
Now, that is very interesting because he never spoke to me. I mean, it wasn't like I was speaking to
James Douglas.
James Douglas never spoke to me. I just received all this information. Like it was a memory.
Right.
Because he wasn't really in spirit form, and I'm not really sure how that would even plan out if I'm still spirit form.
Because you're already reincarnated.
Yeah.
Here.
I'm in a different body. But watch what happened. I gave this information to the archivist. He went back into the vault, comes back out, and he brought the most incredible paper I'd ever seen. Here's a piece of paper that unfolded three times. It was maybe 20 inches by 30 inches. And I said, what in the world is this? It had a great big blue silk ribbon on it, written in the 1800s, and it was signed in the old script. And what it was a transfer from the Ohio State Penitentiary that the warden released James Douglas to the Athens Asylum Center.
The reason that James Douglas went to the penitentiary that
right. I know we're jumping around. It's so much information. So what happened was James finished his service. He's from Ohio in the Civil War. He's shell-shocked from heavy artillery. They take him to Pennsylvania, and he dropped him off and said, well, thanks for your service. See you later. Well, he's like, hey, I'm from Ohio. They said, well, this is as far as train goes or whatever, and they didn't take him the rest of the way. So he starts wandering, and there's a number of people that were kind to him and that sort of thing. But then he makes it to Ohio, and he's not quite home, and he's hungry, and he's sitting in the woods, and he sees a vacant house. This is the whole story. And he goes in the house, and he finds some food. He goes back up into the woods, and then the next night, he comes back, and he does this two or three times. And then he ends up trapped, gets set, and he ends up getting caught. Ends up going to the Ohio Penitentiary for 3 years for breaking and entering. And while he...
Steal food, yeah.
Just because he was hungry and shell-shocked, didn't really know his wits about it. In the penitentiary, it was... a lot of violence, he's in a lot of fights. And the warden apparently is a veteran and actually was saved by the heavy artillery a number of times and showed pity on James. So he thought, I will do something better for him and release him to the asylum, which is a big farm, and he'll go there and have a better life than being here in a prison. So that's what this huge piece of paper, which is in the archive, is about. And he goes down to the asylum, and that's where everything turned sideways, and James started to be tested upon, and all of the early things that happened to people in the asylum. He ended up, he had a lot of anger and confusion, and it led to
there must have been countless tens, if not hundreds of thousands of participants.
And James started to be tested upon, and all of the early things that happened to people in the asylum. He ended up, he had a lot of anger and confusion, and it led to
there must have been countless tens, if not hundreds of thousands of participants. Crazy, horrible.
Correct, yep. And we also have a writer. We have a surgeon, a doctor that wrote in the book. He's one of the stories that talks about that in great length, too.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So that's what happened to James. He had a very difficult time. He ended up being buried up there. And it's not too often, I don't think, very many people get a chance to visit the grave of their past experience.
We'll actually place a marker.
Place a marker there. We did place a marker and a flag, got him a flag, and that story is kind of an amazing story, but didn't end up in the book. It wasn't one of those that ended up in the book.
And then, you know, Ted's group, Jeff, 177 in a non-physical that are waiting here till this project is completed. They told us that, I said, how did these stories, the 28 stories, how did they get chosen for the book? And they said, well, we sort of did sort of a lottery. Everybody's story is just as important as the next one. But we did a lottery, and there were 28 stories that were drawn, and that's who we chose to put in the book. And but each story is just as unique as the other one. It's just as important.
Right. So Ted, the leader of this group of souls, explained how those who are in the book were chosen. It's kind of a semi-random thing, but there were reasons. Can we step sideways for a moment? Who's Ted? Do we know?
Yes.
Do you want to hold it off? We'll hold it off till later. That's fine.
So, Ted ended up being Theodore Mahn.
M-A-H-N, yeah.
M-A-H-N. Exactly.
Uh-huh. And the library in Athens, where all the archives are for the asylum, the vault, is actually the Mahn Library. So we believe it's his. You know, the library was named after. So, Ted Theodore Mahn. And he told us, he gave us a challenge to look for him and find out who he was. So we did the detective work on our own, and when we found him, he goes, you got it, that's me.
Wow, okay.
He called himself Ted, but it's Theodore Mahn, M-A-H-N.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Sounds German almost.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I never thought about
that. Well, there were a lot of immigrants here at that time in our country's history from Europe. They built it, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
So some more interesting facts about this book is I have never, I'm a craftsman. I'm a blacksmith. I've spent 43 years being a decorative iron worker and in restoration and shoeing heavy horses. I've never read a book. It's not my thing.
Other than the Bible.
Other than the Bible.
Uh-huh.
I am a very visual person, so reading is just not my thing. So this book was actually compiled in 12 weeks. It was speed writing. And the interesting thing about the manuscript, we have the original manuscript, there's a number of things that's really interesting. Number one, there's no scribbled out words. There was never a pause like where you would sit and say, how am I going to phrase that? Because for me, all I did was I heard somebody speaking and then I just wrote down what they said. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to think
about
details.
But again, you were writing usually in just print.
Correct.
You weren't writing cursive. Go ahead.
No.
You only
wrote
in cursive one time,
one of the speakers came through, and I was writing, and Bertie looked over my shoulder, and it was the most beautiful cursive that you'd ever seen.
Yeah, it's like a female cursive handwriting from the old days. You know.
Bertie was floored because she knows that I can't write cursive. I just have never learned to do that. There was another speaker that spoke to me and actually wrote left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
There was one time and two speakers speaking, and I wrote left and right-handed at the same time, two stories. That didn't last very long, but it did happen.
Yeah.
And then...
But the interesting thing is when Ted speaks and he writes his words, it's the exact same handwriting every time Ted speaks. If you go through and compare his notes...
So, in other words, you're we'll call it automatic writing, whatever. You're writing, and these people's particular handwriting style will manifest through you and your writing.
Exactly. Yeah. So we took it to a handwriting analysis analyst, and they actually looked at it and confirmed that. this is interesting. Ed, if I'm writing in a spiral notebook that's got blue, Ted would never stay in the line.
Yeah.
His they're up and down, and he doesn't stay in the line.
So I asked him one day.
He asked him, why in the world don't you stay in the lines? And he goes,
you're so messy. Why do you write it over the page?
And he said, sorry, I'm just not used to having lines on the paper.
He said it was all blank paper. We didn't have lines then.
So that's interesting. Yeah, there's five or six different styles or seven. I don't know. There's a lot of different styles.
He also writes his own guide, Adam. He talks to us, you know, frequently. He used to just speak to us in writing. And every time he wrote Adam's words, it was always the same exact handwriting. So it is, when he wrote the little girl story, it was very childlike writing.
Yeah.
All very interesting.
Super crazy. Thumbing through the literature right now, and you can see that.
That's fascinating. Their personalities came through your handwriting. That's just, it's remarkable.
Yeah.
Not just in the words and what they said, but the style of the writing.
Perhaps next time I'll do a visual for your audience that can see. The next time we come on, I'm putting together a video with visuals so that we can show you some of this stuff and everyone can see. Like our original manuscripts, we'll be glad to share some of the copies of that.
Oh, the examples of the writing and the different people. That would be fun.
Absolutely. And then they can compare the different dates, you know, and the same person that wrote it. And then also, today we wanted to talk about talked about this last time, there were three cemeteries at the asylum in Athens. They had three cemeteries. And in the first one and the second one combined, there were 1,777 markers with only just a number when we first started this project. Well, in 1943, they started placing markers with names and birth dates and deaths. So the first female that was placed with a number was, you can go ahead and tell them, you can read it better than
Lucinda Wilson. She was born in 1868, died in 1943. So this was curious to us, because when we started this project, the purpose of these writers were to show people that just because you went to the asylum did not make you less of a human being. They had lives, they had pets, they had dreams and ambitions, they had a story.
Yeah, well, that's why I mentioned in the beginning, these were not psychopaths. These were people who just needed help. And the culture we lived in then used to extend help, emotional help, to many more people than it does now.
So when we approached the owners of the cemetery about our idea that we wanted to leave the old stones in place and put a ground-level stone at the ground, a ground level that said their name, their birth date, and their death date, and their patient number, because what's happening is these stones are 160 or 70 years old, and the mowers are hitting them and breaking them off.
Oh,
and if they break them off, then they get buried or they get misplaced, and now your final resting place is gone.
Or they get stolen.
Yes, stolen. People do that. I've never understood that. Why people steal tombstones, but they do. It's an odd thing. Where are you going to display it? In your living room? All right, are you back?
We're back.
Okay.
So when we approached the owners of the cemetery about our desire to place these ground-level stones with a birth date, death date, and a patient number, they came up with great resistance. And the problem that we're having is that these stones are so old, when a mower hits them or they get stolen, they get broken, there's no record to show who is buried there. And if you want to go and visit your relative, you don't know where these grave sites are. So when we had this huge meeting, the resistance said that they would not allow us to do this because it was a violation of the privacy of the survivors of those patients. And we weren't prepared for this argument, because right here, if you look, in 1943, they started burying people with their names and their birth date and their death date. But pre-1943, those people do not deserve to have their name. They're not allowed to have their name.
They have different privacy, right?
And that didn't make sense to us. So we're,
was that privacy or just lack of concern?
No, well, I think it was an administration thing. So I was upset at first because of this fact, and then I started thinking, let's think through this, Jeff. The year is 1875, and there's a guy, and we'll just call him Bill. He's at the asylum, and he dies, and he's from northeast Ohio, up around, let's just say he's up around Canton. So back in that day, you have to take a piece of paper, and you have to write a letter that says, hey, Uncle Bill just passed away, and you need to come and get his body, and you have to lick a stamp, put it on it, and it has to go clear to Canton. I don't know how long that would take in the 1880s. Then people up there have to make arrangements to get on a train, come down, gather the body.
Well, and they didn't have refrigeration back then like they do now.
Exactly. So this was the refrigerator. What they did was they put a number on this body, put it in, because all of the graves are very shallow. They're not even wrapped in coffins. They're not even buried in coffins. They're wrapped in shrouds, and they're only 2 feet above the dirt above them. So this was just a holding ground until the family could get to them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then there was some family that didn't come and get them. And that's when in 1943 they sat down and they said, look, some people's people might not come and gather them up, and they're going to stay here, so let's just start putting names. And that's my real deep feeling. I just think it was a clerical mix-up.
Was this common, Doug, around the rest of the country, the eastern U.S., after the Civil War, for people who died in government institutions like this? They just get a number on the tombstone?
Very common. When we started having newspaper articles and interviews, we started getting calls from all over the place. There was a big cemetery in Georgia. There's one in Boston.
Yeah.
There's one in Washington State. And they're not only institutions, but they're orphanages, hospitals, those sort of places. And the unfortunate thing, if I remember, in Boston, there's a huge cemetery with maybe 4,000 or 5,000 graves, and there is a record that of only 200 or 300 names. The rest of them are lost. In our situation, we actually have the master list
of everyone except the first 45 males.
Right. So our cemetery is actually a doable project, but then we ended up meeting this resistance, which we hope we can get past it now.
Yeah.
Things have changed.
We're going to approach the new administration that is now, and our biggest opponent has passed on. So he was in Athens.
Do you remember the argument they said, this is a violation of the privacy of those survivors? Well, the state made us do this. We had to do genealogy in reverse. Now, I had the spiritual insight information. Then we would start to find surviving relatives. We would call them up and we would say, hey, we think we found your great-great-uncle Joe, and we know where he is. And the response on the other side of the phone was tears. And they would be like, oh, my God, thank you. We can't believe that you cared enough to do this, because on our family tree, that branch was snapped off, and nobody talked about it. We have no idea where Uncle Joe was. Thank you for finding him. Then we would help them get a stone. Bertie and I would go and do the legwork and place the stone.
If in the family, some families did come. Many of them would come when we placed the marker, if they could. And then we would go with them and do the work with them. And the Ohio Army ROTC at OU helped us place almost every marker. One that we marked. And we would put cement on the bottom of this new marker so it would stay in place, but also the old marker so that it would stay straightened with that one and it wouldn't be knocked off.
So a great healing is taking place on this program. And one of the stories that stands out the most to me was there was, and I can't remember the details of the year, but it we do have it recorded. And we're just going to say there's a husband and a wife, mm-hmm. and he marries her and has, I think, four or five children.
One of the books.
And then he decided he got the eye for another woman. And in the day, he was able to go to the judge and he said, listen, we've been friends since kids. I want you to say that my wife is crazy and admit her to the asylum. And he did. And so she went into the asylum, and she was there the rest of her life, and she was buried in a cemetery. She never saw children again.
Oh, come on. This is inhuman. What happened to the kids? Did they stay together at least? Do we know?
This is a true story.
We found the relatives.
So here's what happened. Dad said mom died or disappeared or something. She never saw her children again. She stayed the rest of her life at the asylum. And then he remarried and ended up four or five more children. So now you've got this huge family. And there was always this rift in between the kids. There was this division. So when we found this information, we contacted the family, told them the story, and both families, the children, showed up at the cemetery to lay this stone. And a great healing was able to take place because they never knew the real story. And that was one of the tragedies of, you know, this asylum and the time period that we lived in. That's actually a true story. We have that all documented.
Yeah. That's actually one of the stories in our book.
Okay, so we've got 170-some people who are in process of having how many?
177
non-physical. All right. Now, you're in process of giving them proper tombstones, headstones, markers, monuments, whatever you want to call them. Now
But they don't want just for them.
They don't what?
They don't want just for the 177. They want us to do it for all 1,777 that were just the number. And so far, we placed... let me see. I got the number here. So far, you know, we placed like over 100 markers, and like 47 of them are veterans, and we have many more veterans markers and civilian markers to do. I mean, if you take
1,077,
we've only done 100 and some. You know, we've got a long ways to go. If we didn't have the opposition from the state, we never asked the state for a dime. We said we will raise the funds, private donations. We did car washes, you know, cookie and baking sales. We did all kinds of, you know, events. And we tried to sell our book at places so that we could take the proceeds and get more markers. And we have, you know, a company that gave us a price of $80 for the civilian markers and $150 for the veterans markers because after the first 45 veteran markers that we placed, mm-hmm. the first 45 were covered by the military.
That's the least they can do.
And then after that, they said, we can no longer pay for them. Remember this stuff?
Yeah.
And we can give $350 billion to Ukraine to kill people. To fund a war, but we can't. Come on, and that's an abomination even to hear.
It is. So now we have to raise our own funds even for the veterans because the Veterans Administration will not pay for them. Do you remember the reason they gave us? I can remember the reason.
It just policy changed.
Yeah.
This policy changed. Yeah. That was pretty sad.
Yeah. So yes. Yeah, so basically,
this is really disgusting. I have another question. Go ahead, Bertie.
So, you know, the main purpose of this book was not to name names or get anyone in trouble or get anyone arrested by telling the truth of what happened behind those walls. Because we have a doctor that came forth, a surgeon that came forth and told his story from his side, you know, that's part of Ted's group. We have a nurse. We have an attendant, a gardens attendant. We have little kids. We have veterans. We have wives of, you know, they had family members that are in the military, you know, and the veterans. And then we have that suffered in a different manner. And they were also ended up at the asylum. And so there's a plethora of stories in the book, but the purpose was not to get anyone in trouble or anyone jailed, or just so that the truth can be known, because their main message is, you know, we are more than just a number. We too have lived, loved, and laughed. And everyone has a story, and you should hear our story and know our story. So when we met with Ms. Strickland, she was the first lady at the time, when Governor Strickland was in office, he wouldn't have make the time to meet with us in our group. So we had all the dignitaries in the state of Ohio for mental advocacy people. And Mrs. Strickland, the first lady, said to me, Berta, if I walk past a number, a numbered headstone with just a number, I think of all the things that, you know, this person was. But if I walk by... And I said, well, if you walk up by and you have a name, birthday, and death date, not only can you, do you have to think of who they were, you can actually look them up and find out who they really were,
yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Why would a number be more of a mystery for you and you think of it more? It just didn't make sense to me. But the other reason that they, you know, because we had two family members during this meeting that flew in from, one from Washington State, Washington, D.C., and another one from, I think, Pennsylvania or Texas. And they were there in the meeting, and they said, only family members are allowed to place markers. You guys can't do it. You Johnny come lately, so why don't you go and move some stones around somewhere else in Columbus or something. That's exactly their words. These were the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill president said that to us in Athens, and I thought, wow.
And this also, you know, they made it, they really took it as an Athens project or an Athens thing, and there are 77 counties out of 88 in Ohio that's represented in that cemetery.
Right.
So this is a statewide concern, not just Athens.
Right.
It had nothing to do with
All right.
And, you know, another group that we contacted to help us with funding and helping us find family members was the NAACP. And the person that contacted us said, oh, we would love to help you, but we only help living people.
Yeah, well, that didn't make any sense.
That's a stretch for some people. I get it. So what we're saying here is that at least in the case of the asylum people who were there, who died there, maybe some got out, I don't know, but they were there.
Some did get out, yeah.
And they were not, they're hanging around because they weren't appropriately given the integrity that they were deserving of. No
Correct.
Marker, no monument, name, birth date, death date, none of that, just a number. And so they're
right.
Hanging around. Now, for them, time is irrelevant, I would think. So they don't measure things in time. That would be my guess. So, but they've
Correct.
Been waiting around for quite a while, to say the least. And are you hearing from Ted or the others directly that my marker is up, I can go home, or I can go on now? Are you hearing any kind of resolution when you get these things done?
I'm going to say that they're all still standing.
They're waiting together.
Because it's a group thing. There's a 177 is a representative council of the 1700.
Got it.
1770.
Yeah, so I think that just because we placed, you know, the stones that we placed may not even have been of Ted's group.
Now, we have had, since we're talking of that, Jeff, sorry to interrupt you, Doug.
Mm-hmm.
We have had several of the patients that were still lingering, the spirits, at the cemetery themselves. When we placed their marker, they were there and they thanked us and moved on to the light.
Yeah.
They were not part of the group.
Did they notify both of you mentally, psychically, spiritually, that they're thank you and we're moving on now, whatever?
They acknowledged and thanked us, and they just disappeared into the light.
Well,
that's interesting too, because you know this again was a whole learning process, because I when I see a spirit form person, they look very much like a physical person.
They
other than they may be,
right.
They may be dressed. But if you look at the outline of this person in spirit form, their outline is not as crisp as a physical human being. So it's more it's more fuzzy, and there's a little bit of a blurriness to their details. So sometimes if I'm in the cemetery or a spirit form walks up to me, it takes me a second before I can, you know, make that determination that they're in spirit form. So that's when we were at the cemetery, and people will be like I have the ability to see them. You know, we're at the cemetery, we're straightening flags or doing something, and there's a being standing over just looking at a stone or looking up into the sky. And if they're by themselves, first off, that's a little bit odd. And then as we, you know, they'll either approach us or
we approach them,
and then we can hear their story. And there's all kinds of different...
They talk to you in three-dimensional presence. They tell you the story right there. You're looking at them. Do they cast a shadow? Do you ever notice that?
No.
See, it sounds like they're using energy to project their human form so you can interact with it. It's got to be something like that, no?
That is a very good observation, Jeff. And as you said that, no, they do not cast a shadow. They're not that solid.
Got it. It's energy. So they are recreating themselves in order to open a channel to you. All makes sense, and it's stuff we've heard about most of our lives, I think. Ghosts, what we'd call ghosts.
Yeah.
One wonders, of all the billions of people on the planet, lots of them are dying, how many of them are hanging around? Not necessarily to get the respect they feel they deserve, like these people are, but other reasons.
Right.
They're angry, they're unhappy, unfinished business, etc. There must be a lot of people energetically who are still here. We don't
Absolutely.
See them unless they want us to see them. So there's
Correct.
Your potential for a ghost explanation. Interesting.
Yeah, well, we have many stories we can share with your audience. Maybe one of these nights we can pick several of the things that we have experienced of people that were not part of Ted's group or at the cemetery, but at people's houses. People find out about our gifts and that we want to help people. So we have any experiences that we can share with you that were truly amazing and truly, really a learning curve for just anybody to know that you too can do this and help those spirits move on.
Will they allow pictures? Have you tried?
We have a lot of pictures of orbs. We've never really asked, may we take a picture? The one that I really wanted a picture of is we had a general that showed up in our living room one time when we were placing 45 veteran markers the next morning, and Doug and I were up late writing the names on the flags so that we would put flags at the beginning of the row and where the marker was going to go, so there was no question where the marker was the next morning. And we had lots of groups coming to help us. And we were making big, giant pots of chili and food for everybody, all the volunteers. And the general showed up in spirit form in our living room to thank us. So maybe next time it's two pages that he wrote, such kind words. And we found them on the internet. We found out he was a real general. And he said that he is standing here until all his men get recognition.
Oh, amazing. Really amazing.
He is not part of Ted's group. He's a different person that found out about us and decided he's going to come and hang around. He has already crossed over, but he is here to help us until they're all recognized, he said. Until all my men are recognized, something like that.
That's a great general. A lot of them don't have that kind of, I think, integrity. That's really something.
Yes.
What a story.
I wish I could have asked him to please, you know, manifest in my picture, because that would have been beautiful. I mean, it was very heartwarming that he just was hanging around and came over to thank us.
Did he show up in his uniform?
He was in a uniform.
Full uniform, yeah.
We wrote the details down, and that's how we could recognize his rank and actually who he was. But, you know, it's interesting when you read his words, it sounds just totally, it just is the old way of speaking, and it's very unique.
I'll have that visual for you next time for your audience. It's very, very beautiful what he said.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for sharing again, and get well. Take care of yourselves, obviously. You've got a lot of work to do. This is really very, very interesting, the connection between this plane and the next plane, and how they can reach right across. They can reach right across.
It is. Yes.
Yeah.
The very first part of the book, if you look at the cover, it says Souls of the Asylum, a clairaudient experience. Clairaudient means heard it. And at the bottom, the disclaimer says, as received by Doug and Bertha. That's our disclaimer that we didn't write this. All I did was recorded it. And it's our
very
job
good.
To pass this along for them.
Okay. All right.
Until
we'll talk soon.
I'm Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank
all right.
you.
Have
Bye.
A good night.
Okay. You too. Thanks. Thanks very much. All right. That's part two with Doug and Bertie. And we'll follow along with this story. There's much, much more. All right, we'll be back with hour two for you next.